focused on helping them control their emotions. The standard treatment for abusive parents. After the therapy sessions concluded, the parents were tracked for 3 years. Across 3 years, 60% of the anger management therapy group committed another act of child abuse. In contrast, only 20% of the PCIT parents reoffended. PCIT did not eliminate the problem. 1 in 5 parents abused his or her kids again. But, from the perspective of behavior change, the results are staggering. Most of us believe in our hearts that child abusers are irredeemably flawed. Who could hit a child other than someone who is disturbed in some basic way? It simply boggles the mind to think that the behavior of child abusers could be altered by only 12 sessions of therapy, concentrating on such simple instructions. Funderburk said, "In my experience, the physically abusive parent has the same goals as a normal parent. It's their method and their ideas that are wrong. They think their child is woeful because they told their 3-year-old to just play in the front yard, and then he wandered off into the street. And they don't understand that a 3-year-old might forget an instruction or might not have that kind of impulse control. So they think they have to punish the child for his own good because he was disobedient and dangerous." Earlier, we said what looks like stubbornness or opposition may actually be a lack of clarity. The PCIT intervention suggests that child abuse, too, may be partly the result of a lack of understanding, a lack of clear instruction or guidance on what to do. This is not to excuse the parent's behavior, of course. It is simply to point out that simple scripting has power beyond what any of us could have predicted. Even child abusers become pliable in its presence. 7. In 1995, the same year Brazil's President Cardoso announced the privatization of the railroads, a group of high school students in Howard, South Dakota started plotting a revival. They wanted to do something, anything, that might revive their dying community. Howard and surrounding Minor County had been shrinking for decades. Farm and industrial jobs had slowly dried up, and nothing replaced them. The median price of houses in Howard was only $26,500. The population was about 3,000 and shrinking. The county had the highest elderly population per capita in South Dakota, and it also had the highest rate of youth outmigration in South Dakota, meaning that when young people got old enough, they left and didn't return. "We'd been in decline for 90 years," said Randy Perry, a longtime resident who taught a business class at the local high school, coached the varsity basketball team, and ran an ice cream parlor on the side. At Howard High School, the students had just finished reading a book about the death of rural communities in Iowa. The students said, "That's us. It's just 70 years from now," according to Perry. So in class, they started asking, "How could we change this?" Imagine the decision paralysis in this situation. Think of how many factors influence a town's health: its history, its demographics, its location, its economic base, its weather, among countless others. The problem was simply too complex for anyone to solve. And it wasn't for lack of motivation. There wasn't one person in Minor County who wouldn't have jumped at the chance to help rejuvenate the community. The elephant herd was ready to move, but where? What can a few people do to restore an entire county? The students started investigating the situation, designing a survey and distributing it to a sample of Minor County's 1,000 registered voters. One finding in particular disturbed them. They discovered that half of the residents were shopping outside the county, driving an hour to Sioux Falls to shop in larger stores. If Minor County was going to be reborn, its economy would need a boost. Most of the things that would boost an economy, investment, entrepreneurship, immigration, were out of the students' control. But they had uncovered one thing that was very much in their control: spending money locally. They had found their first rallying cry: "Let's keep Minor dollars in Minor County." Perry urged the students to present their findings to the community. The students accepted the challenge and began to put together a presentation. The students' newfound interest in revitalization dovetailed with the efforts of others in the community. A group of other Minor County citizens had been hosting a series of meetings intended to get county residents talking about the future. They held 5 gatherings, some in the high school and some in people's homes, and they invited a cross-section of residents, farmers and business people and ministers and retirees. They challenged each other. What can we do to energize Minor County? The issues raised were all over the map. Why does our town look so shabby with rusty cars on the street? Why should a farmer get a subsidy when a business person doesn't get a subsidy? Why don't we have a more thriving Main Street? Many of the issues were TBU, unsolvable by the community. Many required investment, but with a limited pool of tax dollars to draw from. It wasn't clear where they'd find the money, but there were a few things they knew they could take into their own hands. A gas station owner in the town of Fedora, population 150, complained that residents years ago had cut down a lot of diseased trees. Stumps were still littering the area, making Fedora look run down and sad. A group of concerned citizens decided to deal with the stumps in Fedora. One Saturday, farmers carrying chainsaws rode into Fedora on their tractors and loaders. Other residents made sandwiches and cookies for the workers. In a single day, the group dug up 400 stumps. Kathy Callies, who was heading up the kitchen crew that day, said it was amazing to see 50 people, ages ranging from 5 to 95, come together to do something for their community. Callies recalled that by the end of the day, people felt like, look at what we did in a day. And when you've dug up stumps together, and you start to realize you have shared ideas about what you want the community to be, then things start to happen. Notice that the log clearing day had powerful elephant and path elements as well. The flush of victory, of making a difference, gave the elephant strength to continue, and the strong support of the community made the path feel less difficult. It's easier to make a long journey when you've got a herd around you. The community began to rally around the movement. Callies remembered the day that Phyllis, a civic-minded woman in her 80s, dropped by the office where the community boosters were meeting. Phyllis announced, "I've been waiting for you to call me. I thought if you needed my help, you would call. But then I realized, oh, they're all too busy to call. So here I am." On her refrigerator at home, Phyllis had posted a cross stitch that said, "Screw the golden years." When the high school students were ready to unveil their recommendations, 85 residents gathered in the high school gym to hear the presentation. Among them were the top leaders of the towns in Minor County, the school boards, the city councils, and city commissioners. The crowd listened attentively to the high school students. Perry said, "You could hear a pin drop." People said, "I can't say no because I want to make this a place where these kids can come home someday. Because the other option is we sit here and keep watching these things decline. Pretty soon all that will be left is the dust." The students had prepared an impressive array of spreadsheets and charts and graphs. But they'd also simplified the complex data into one simple surprising fact. They'd calculated that if Howard residents spent just 10% more of their disposable income at home, they would boost the local economy by $7 million. The audience was impressed, and the presentation worked better than anyone expected. The students had scripted the first critical move for Minor County, and the locals responded immediately, consciously spending more of their money in the county. A year later, South Dakota's Department of Revenue released an astonishing number. The amount of money spent in Minor County had increased by $15.6 million, more than twice the increase the kids had expected. The change began to snowball. Suddenly, because the county was collecting more taxes, money was available to fund the other proposals the local groups had considered. And in the years following the students' presentation, the tax receipts kept climbing, which enabled the community to tackle even more ambitious problems. Later, Howard and Minor County received $6 million in grants from various foundations to fuel the transformation. Randy Perry left his teaching job and became a full-time revitalizer-in-chief. The town of Howard became the host to 21st century businesses such as an organic beef producer and a wind turbine repair shop. "It all started small," said Perry. "It's like when I took over the basketball team at the high school. They were just coming off a losing season, and you couldn't get people to come into the gym. But then you start to win, and a few people come, and then more people come. And then we started winning a lot." To date, Perry has discussed the rebirth of Minor County with community leaders from 33 different states. 8. a railroad, and a small South Dakota town, both crumbling, both with a dense thicket of problems and no real resources to use in untangling them. In each situation, an unlikely leader emerged. A young man fresh out of business school, and a high school basketball coach, and both succeeded by formulating solutions that were strikingly smaller than the problems they were intended to solve. We've seen this asymmetry before in the stories of Jerry Sternin in Vietnam and Bobby the troubled teenager. The challenges facing Minor County were big and sprawling. The decline of an industrial base, the aging of a population. The citizens understood these challenges well, but the knowledge was TBU, true but useless. It was paralyzing knowledge. To the rider, a big problem calls for a big solution. But if you seek out a solution that's as complex as the problem, you'll get the food pyramid, and nothing will change. The rider will just spin his wheels trying to make sense of it. The rider has to be jarred out of introspection, out of analysis. He needs a script that explains how to act, and that's why the successes we've seen have involved such crisp direction. Buy 1% milk. Don't spend cash unless it makes cash. Shop a little more in Minor County. We all hear a lot of common sense wisdom about change. People don't like to change. People resist change. People are set in their ways. People are stubborn. But here, we've seen something else entirely. Railroads made profitable, towns reborn, diets changed, and child abusers reformed. Clarity dissolves resistance. Chapter 4. Point to the Destination. 1. Crystal Jones joined Teach for America in 2003. She was assigned to teach the first grade class at an elementary school in Atlanta, Georgia. The school had no kindergarten, so for many of the kids, Jones would be their first teacher. At the beginning of the year, the skill gaps among her students were daunting. She said, "I had two or three students who could recognize kindergarten sight words, and I also had some that couldn't even hold their pencils. The ones who had never been to school, their basic behavior wasn't where it needed to be for them to be in the classroom. I had students that, of course, didn't know their alphabet or their numbers. They were all on different levels, and no one was really where they needed to be for first grade." Jones felt confident that she could elevate the kids' abilities. She could create great lesson plans and activities. She could script the critical moves. But to what end? How do you show a room full of first graders where they're headed and why going there is worth the effort in terms they can understand? Well, here's a way not to do that, from another Teach for America teacher, who reported her goals for the year as follows. "With respect to reading for the school year, I administered three diagnostics, CWT, Assessment of Comprehension and Monster Test. Using the CWT, I identified my class's average as grade level 1.5 in September. My goal is to increase my students' word identification so as to ensure a class average of 3.0. Upon analyzing the results of the assessment of comprehension, I identified my class's average as 41% in September. My goal is to increase my students' comprehension so as to ensure a class average of 80%. Using the Monster Test, I identified my class's average score as semiphonetic phonetic. My goal is to increase my students' phonics and spelling skills to transitional." That ambitious and specific set of goals was probably quite useful to the teacher in her planning, but it obviously won't be useful in lighting a fire in the hearts of first graders. Crystal Jones, in contrast, knew that if she wanted to motivate the kids, she had to speak their language. At the beginning of the school year, she announced a goal for her class that she knew would captivate every student. "By the end of this school year, you're going to be third graders." Not literally, of course, but in the sense that they would be at third grade skill levels. That goal was tailor-made for the first grade psyche. First graders know very well what third graders look like. They are bigger, smarter, cooler. You know the feeling you get when you're admiring the grace and power of an Olympic athlete? That's the feeling first graders get about third graders. Jones chose the goal carefully. She knew exactly what the third grade standards in Georgia required, and she knew where her kids were starting. She genuinely thought she could close the gap. One of her first efforts was to cultivate a culture of learning in her classroom, calling her students scholars and asking them to address one another that way. When people visited her classroom, she introduced her class as a group of scholars and asked them to define the term for the guest. They would shout, "A scholar is someone who lives to learn and is good at it." The scholars were encouraged to go home and share what they learned with their families. One day, a scholar was called out of the classroom for administrative reasons, and some of the others in the room started groaning. In most classrooms, it would have been a groan of jealousy. "Get me out of here, too!" Jones realized, to her surprise, that it was a groan of pity. "That kid is going to miss some scholar work." At that moment, Jones said, "I knew I had them." By springtime, the kids' test scores had reached second grade level, so Jones threw a graduation ceremony right before spring break. For the rest of the year, the kids took pleasure in referring to themselves as second graders, and by the end of the year, over 90% of the kids were reading at or above third grade level. These were some of the same kids who 9 months earlier didn't know the alphabet. Crystal Jones's challenge is reminiscent of what Jim Collins and Jerry Porras in Built to Last, their great study of long-lived business organizations, memorably called a BHAG, a big, hairy, audacious goal. Henry Ford's BHAG early in the 20th century was to democratize the automobile. Walmart in 1990 set the goal of quadrupling in size to be a $125 billion company by the year 2000. Collins and Porras defined a BHAG as an audacious 10- to 30-year goal to progress towards an envisioned future, and their research showed that setting these big motivating goals was a practice that distinguished lasting companies from less successful ones. In creating change, though, we're interested in goals that are closer at hand, the kinds of things that can be tackled by parents or middle managers or social activists. We want a goal that can be tackled in months or years, not decades. We want what we might call a destination postcard, a vivid picture from the near-term future that shows what could be possible. That's the missing piece of what we've discussed so far. We've seen the importance of pursuing bright spots, and we've discussed ways of instructing the rider how to behave, but we haven't answered a very basic question. Where are we headed in the end? What's the destination? Crystal Jones provided a great destination postcard. You'll be third graders soon. Notice that the goal she set for her students didn't only direct the rider, it also motivated the elephant. It was inspirational. It tapped into feeling. Collins and Porras knew that goals should have an emotional component. A BHAG shouldn't just be big and compelling. It should hit you in the gut. To a first grader, becoming a third grader in 9 months is a gut-smacking goal. 2. Women with breast cancer flew to San Francisco to be treated by Laura Esserman, a surgeon and an associate professor of surgery at the University of California at San Francisco, UCSF. Patients loved Esserman for her warmth and empathy. She gave out her personal cell phone number to her patients, and she sometimes sang patients to sleep in the operating room as their anesthesia took effect. Esserman's human touch was in sharp contrast to the usual treatment afforded women diagnosed with breast cancer. As if the diagnosis itself weren't frightening enough, women were often bounced around from place to place during the treatment cycle, adding stress. In a typical progression, described by a Stanford case study, a woman first notices a lump on her breast during a monthly self-exam. Anxious, she calls a doctor and waits a few days or weeks for an appointment. The doctor confirms that the lump should be examined. So, the patient is referred to a radiologist at another facility to get a mammogram. Getting the results of the scan takes another agonizing few days. The mammogram shows something suspicious, so she is referred to a surgeon who meets her and again verifies that the lump is present. Unfortunately, the mammogram images didn't arrive at the surgeon's office before the visit, so there's another delay while radiology is contacted. The surgeon conducts a biopsy, which is sent to the pathology department to determine whether the growth contains cancerous cells. The woman is sent home to wait by the phone for the answer. If cancer is detected, she undergoes surgery, and then the surgeon refers her to a radiation therapist for radiation treatment and to a medical oncologist for chemotherapy. Radiation and chemotherapy are conducted at different sites with different booking procedures and delays. In an attempt to smooth the process, a patient might have to collect her own records, films, and pathology slides, and carry them around herself. Sometimes, even within the same hospital, the sequence might take weeks to unfold. And all while the woman is wondering, am I going to live through this? This anxiety-filled process appalled Laura Esserman, and she had a vision of how it could be different. What if there were a breast care clinic where a woman worried about a lump in her breast could walk in at the beginning of the day and walk out at the end of the day with an answer, either knowing that the lump was no problem, or if it was a problem, having a treatment plan already in hand? The main barrier to this vision was the lack of coordination among medical departments. If they could be integrated more tightly, then weeks of agonizing waiting could be eliminated. The patient would not have to leave the building, and the experience would be designed around the patient's needs, not the department's. That was Esserman's destination postcard, and it was an admirable one. But as an associate professor at a large university medical center, Esserman was far down the totem pole, with few resources at her disposal. Even if she could start a breast care clinic, she would never be able to hire or fire people who might work for it, and she couldn't even set their salaries. The medical departments, such as radiology and pathology, controlled the purse strings and the resources. The two most commonly used descriptions of the medical school at UCSF were bureaucratic and political. The departments have money and the departments have turf, and you can't bring them together, said Meredith Mendelson, who became Esserman's chief administrative director. Esserman said, "The radiation oncologists report to radiation oncology. The surgeons report to the School of Medicine. The medical oncologists report to medical oncology. The nurses and staff report to the medical center. The psychologists and social workers report someplace else." So it's an organizational challenge to make people feel like they belong to something. Because Esserman wielded so little institutional power, her best assets for creating change were her own tenacity and her ability to sell a vision of what breast cancer care could be. Esserman and Mendelson started small. They set up the breast care center to operate for 4 hours one day per week. They cajoled the medical departments to start working together in more integrated ways. It took practice and it took persistence. Radiology, which does the mammographies, works like a train station, said Mendelson. If your appointment's at 12:15, you're seen at 12:15, and that's how they operate. But Esserman's goal was to build treatment around the patient's needs, and those needs weren't always predictable enough to conform to radiology's schedule. Esserman worked with the radiologists to figure out how to create some flexibility in their traditionally rigid processes. We couldn't take up too much of radiology's time, said Mendelson. So they figured out how to improvise. Dr. Esserman would see the patient in the morning, and she was the only doctor that would do it. She was the guinea pig, and then she would send them off. Say, go have lunch, go shopping, come back at 1 o'clock. And during lunchtime, she would go to radiology, where she and the radiologist would sit and look through all of the images and decide what needed to happen next. For the first year, the center stuck with the one-day-per-week model. Then, once the work was going smoothly, Esserman expanded to 2 days per week. More surgeons started to get involved, and then nurses and counselors and support staff, and the snowball began. Eventually, the breast care center achieved enough success that it was offered an entire floor in a new cancer center being constructed by UCSF. "Where's radiology?" asked Esserman when she saw the layout. The Cancer Center master plan assumed that the radiology department would remain in its old building, but that would have made Esserman's everything-under-one-roof vision impossible. So she agreed to give up one-third of the breast care center's space to make room for a mammography unit on the same floor. Onlookers were shocked. Academic departments usually fought hard to secure space, and Esserman was giving up some of hers. Now Esserman had two powerful assets, a proper home for the center and a staff who increasingly embraced her vision for a new kind of care. Patients flocked to the Breast Cancer Center. From 1997 to 2003, the number of patients seen per month skyrocketed from 175 to 1,300. In time, the center became a major source of revenue for UCSF and a recognized national leader in breast cancer care and research. The center evolved to be the place that Esserman described in her destination postcard. Here's how Esserman describes the way the patient's experience looks today. When a patient comes into the breast care center, I can walk around the corner and look at her films that day. While she's in the room, we can do a biopsy and get the diagnosis in 5 minutes. We have a gynecologist on staff that specializes in fertility issues for women with breast cancer. And I have a psychologist and genetic counselor on staff that is one of the nurse practitioners. The patient stays in the same place and doesn't need to go anywhere. The breast care center also has a relaxing healing garden and a cafe that serves coffee. The boutique sells not only the usual flowers and gifts, but also wigs and scarves for the patients undergoing chemo. For the first time, said Esserman, we put the woman at the center. 3. When you describe a compelling destination, you're helping to correct one of the writer's great weaknesses, the tendency to get lost in analysis. Our first instinct in most change situations is to offer up data to people's writers. Here's why we need to change. Here are the tables and graphs and charts that prove it. The writer loves this. He'll start poring over the data, analyzing it and poking holes in it, and he'll be inclined to debate you about the conclusions you've drawn. To the writer, the analyzing phase is often more satisfying than the doing phase, and that's dangerous for your switch. Notice what happens, though, when you point to an attractive destination. The writer starts applying his strengths to figuring out how to get there. For instance, after Esserman announced her under-one-roof vision, her team could start thinking through the implications of that. Let's see. We'll never pull that off unless we have access to radiology, so we'll need to give up some square footage to them. You have a choice about how to use the writer's energy. By default, he'll obsess about which way to move or whether it's necessary to move at all. But you can redirect that energy to helping you navigate toward the destination. For that to happen, you need a gut-smacking goal, one that appeals to both rider and elephant. Think of Esserman's under-one-roof vision, or of Crystal Jones's challenge to her kids to become third graders. Goals in most organizations, however, lack emotional resonance. Instead, smart goals, goals that are specific, measurable, actionable, relevant, and timely, have become the norm. A typical SMART goal might be, my marketing campaign will generate 4,500 qualified sales leads for the sales group by the end of Q3 09. The specificity of SMART goals is a great cure for the worst sins of goal setting, ambiguity and irrelevance. We are going to delight our customers every day in every way, but SMART goals are better for steady-state situations than for change situations because the assumptions underlying them are that the goals are worthwhile. If you accept that generating 4,500 leads for the sales force is a great use of your time, the SMART goal will be effective. But if a new boss, pushing a new direction, assigns you the 4,500 leads goal, even though you've never handled lead generation before, then there might be trouble. SMART goals presume the emotion. They don't generate it. In looking for a goal that reaches the elephant, that hits people in the gut, you can't bank on SMART goals. There are some people whose hearts are set aflutter by goals such as improving the liquidity ratio by 30% over the next 18 months. They're called accountants. In the 1980s, a major study of corporate change efforts found that financial goals inspired successful change less well than did more emotional goals, such as the goal to provide better service to customers or to make more useful products. According to the researchers, effective visions expressed values that allow employees to identify with the organization. One manager at a glass company suggested, it's hard to get excited about 15% return on equity. Destination postcards do double duty. They show the rider where you're headed, and they show the elephant why the journey is worthwhile. Here's a clinic that addresses that. How can you get corporations to avoid short-term thinking? Situation. Judy Samuelson heads a policy think tank with the Aspen Institute called the Business and Society Program. It's committed to fighting short-termism in the business world. Samuelson points out that it's hard to solve global problems, global warming, poverty, energy needs, without the help of the business sector. After all, some businesses have more resources than entire countries. But businesses with a short-term focus can't afford to tackle long-term problems. Samuelson recounts a conversation with the CEO of a huge financial services firm. He tells her that he would like to be involved with the big issues of the day, but he points to the 90-day calendar posted on his wall and admits, "This is my reality." Translation: the public markets are forcing him to adopt a quarter-by-quarter focus. How can Samuelson, the leader of a small nonprofit, possibly influence such massive forces? How can she fight short-termism? This is an actual situation, ongoing as of 2009. We'll discuss some of Samuelson's strategy along with some of our own thinking. What's the switch and what's holding it back? We want executives to act with a longer-term mindset. So what's stopping them? First, there's a big rider problem here. We hope your radar went off when you read the phrase short-termism. It's useful as a one-word summary of the problem that Samuelson is fighting. But to provoke change, we've got to script the critical moves. A long-term mindset isn't a behavior. Second, there's a path problem. The culture of the stock market encourages short-term thinking. Interestingly, the elephant probably isn't the villain here. Most execs would prefer, all things being equal, to have a longer-term focus. That means motivation probably isn't our obstacle. Finally, let's be realistic. Samuelson is seeking a massive change. We can't expect to generate a magic bullet solution, but big changes can start with small steps. How can we improve Samuelson's odds? How do we make the switch? Direct the rider. 1. Script the critical moves. Samuelson finds a way to translate her big-picture goal into specific behaviors. One insight: let's convince executives to stop giving quarterly earnings guidance. Backstory: investors know the bizarre kabuki dance of earnings guidance, but other people may not. Each quarter, a public company sets expectations for the earnings per share it will deliver in its next quarterly financial report. Then, when the company files its report, a miracle occurs. The company announces that it beat the expectations by a penny per share. Oh, glory! The markets find this little game inspiring, but none of it is required by law. A company could simply file its quarterly financial reports without any advance expectation setting. In other words, Samuelson has located a specific behavior that's within the control of the executive. The expectations dance is the perfect symbol of short-term thinking. 2. Point to the destination. Samuelson should sell the vision here. How will life be different for the progressive CEO who rids himself of the burden of managing to the quarter rather than to the long term? What's the destination postcard? Motivate the elephant. Shrink the change. Note that by focusing on quarterly earnings guidance, Samuelson shrinks the change. It's an attainable first step on the road to long-term thinking. 2. Appeal to identity. Samuelson could play up the fact that the CEOs of some well-respected companies, GE, Microsoft, Coca-Cola, Google, and others, have already made this change. If other CEOs want to act like forward-thinking CEOs, this is the step they need to take. Shape the path. 1. Build a habit. Remember the story of Donald Berwick and the campaign to save 100,000 lives? Berwick made it easy for hospitals to join the campaign. They simply submitted the hospital CEO's signature on a one-page form. At that point, Berwick's team swooped in to help the hospital build the new habits. What if Samuelson could make it that easy to join a no-earnings guidance campaign? Her team should offer a simple checklist of things to address, including legal, PR, and operational issues, and support the companies as they change. 2. Rally the herd. Some CEOs are reluctant to discontinue earnings guidance. They worry that investors will think it's a signal that the company is in trouble and will hurry to sell off their stock. Samuelson could help CEOs counter this perception by organizing a drop the guidance day on a certain date. That way, the timing of the announcement would be less conspicuous. Also, by linking together business leaders who are intrigued by the idea, Samuelson could encourage a bandwagon effect. As we'll later see, behavior is contagious. 4. Destination postcards, pictures of a future that hard work can make possible, can be incredibly inspiring. The first graders dreamed of being third graders. Laura Esserman's team imagined a new kind of breast care clinic that would cater to the needs of the patient. But what if your team isn't inspired? What if, in fact, members of your team are secretly or not so secretly resistant to the vision of the future you've articulated? This introduces a new enemy, rationalization. For instance, surely we've all made a New Year's resolution to be healthier. We conjure up a mental image of our future selves, fit and svelte, and we like what we see. But deep inside us, the commitment isn't there. A few days after January 1st, we get hungry and we see that gorgeous bag of Cheetos in the pantry. There's no question what the elephant wants. A big mouthful of Cheetoian goodness. And when the elephant wants something badly, the rider can be trusted to go along. What choice does he have? He may actually begin to formulate rationalizations to excuse the breach. Well, we did eat that salad last Thursday, and for Pete's sake, we bought 1% milk at the grocery store. We don't want to go overboard on this diet. A few Cheetos is a reasonable reward for good behavior. And presto, we eat the Cheetos. Even more impressive than that, we'll still be convinced in our heart of hearts that we're being healthier. A big-picture goal like be healthier is necessarily imprecise, and that ambiguity creates wiggle room for the elephant. It makes it easier to rationalize failure. One response to this dilemma is to set up super-prescriptive goals. Your firm might announce, "We will boost revenue by 14.2% this year." Certainly, that's much better than just urging employees to do their best. But although numbers themselves are wiggle-proof, the way we deal with numbers isn't. For instance, if your firm achieved a 12.3% increase in revenue, do you really think anyone would get fired? Or is it more likely that a compelling rationalization would smooth over the discrepancy? Team, in this economic climate, we should consider 12.3% a huge victory. The danger is present in our personal lives, too. Imagine that, in hopes of reining in your alcohol consumption, you set a goal of drinking no more than one glass of wine per night. Well, let's face it. There will come a night when your elephant is going to crave more than one, and that's when the boundaries are going to get fuzzy. You'll honor your one-glass rule by filling your glass all the way to the brim, or you'll mentally trade an extra drink now for a zero-drink night in the speculative future. We're all loophole-exploiting lawyers when it comes to our own self-control. If you're worried about the possibility of rationalization at home or at work, you need to squeeze out the ambiguity from your goal. You need a black-and-white B&W goal. A B&W goal is an all-or-nothing goal, and it's useful in times when you worry about backsliding. Maybe your B&W goal for your alcohol consumption could be no wine ever. No wiggle room there. And what if we changed our New Year's resolution from be healthier to gym every day, or even no more Cheetos? Those goals leave nowhere to hide. Either you've got damning orange Cheeto dust on your fingers or you don't. Note that B&W goals, no more Cheetos, no wine ever, are not inspiring at all. They're 100% restrictive. Furthermore, they are scripting critical behaviors rather than painting a picture of a destination. Is it possible to combine the emotional power of a destination postcard with the rationalization-squashing strength of a B&W goal? Yes. And to see how, consider the case of British Petroleum, BP. In 1991, BP announced a B&W goal that shocked its employees who had spent years in the oil industry. It was the multi-billion dollar equivalent of no more Cheetos. 5. For most of the 20th century, oil explorers have trusted their gut, which worked out well, because their gut was pretty smart, and oil reserves were largely untapped. In the 1960s, Jim Vanderby, one of the great BP explorers, went to Egypt. The first four or five holes he drilled there were dry. His superiors at BP sent him a telegram and told him to stop trying. He didn't get the telegram, or so he claimed. Regardless, he drilled again. And on his next try in the Gulf of Suez, he tapped into the world's first multi-billion barrel oil field. BP's good fortune continued in the 1960s and 1970s, with huge discoveries such as Prudhoe Bay in Alaska, 1968, and Montrose in the North Sea, 1971, among others. Toward the late 80s, though, the mega-hits slowed down. What was changing was that the fields were getting more difficult to find, said Pete Gallagher, a senior leader at Amoco, which merged with BP in the late 1990s. The older fields were huge, visible on 2D seismic technology. Targets became smaller and more difficult to see, so the skill sets changed. As the landscape changed, BP's strategy evolved. In 1989, its leaders locked into the exploration doctrine that would guide them for the next 15 years. They would focus only on big fields and stop competing for the smaller ones, thereby avoiding competition with hundreds of smaller competitors. They also decided to attack costs. At that time, BP was considered by many to be the world's most effective exploration company. Even so, BP's leaders believed it was spending far too much on exploration. They committed to slash exploration costs from $5 per barrel to $1. People inside the company thought this goal was outrageous. To reduce costs so drastically, BP needed to minimize the number of dry holes it drilled. The historic success rate for drilling a new well was roughly 1 out of 8. BP's rate was much better, 1 out of 5. To cut exploration costs from $5 to $1 per barrel, though, it would have to go from good performance to unprecedented performance. Some said impossible performance. Researchers at BP began to investigate past explorations. One thing they studied was whether explorers were good at predicting the success of their wells. They reviewed wells that had been drilled over a 10-year period and found that, on average, explorers' predictions were extraordinarily accurate. Their average prediction was that a well had a 20% chance of hitting, and on average, 20% of wells actually hit. But the averages concealed some fascinating biases. For instance, when the explorers gave the well a 20 to 70% probability of hitting, their predictions were pretty accurate. But when the explorers predicted a greater than 75% chance of success, the wells hit nearly all the time. Also, wells that had been given a 10% chance of success actually had more like a 1% chance. So the explorers' instincts about the wells were correct. They knew the good ones from the bad ones. But there was information, especially for high and low probability wells, that they weren't using. Traditionally, the explorers had been salesmen for their wells, pressing top management for the green light to drill. In the 1980s, they had learned the way to sell management was to use the tools of risk economics, in particular, the concept of expected value. Expected value calculations are bulletproof in situations where the risks and returns are well understood. If I flip a coin, you can feel confident that you have a 50% probability of winning. But what are the odds of hitting a gusher? And if you hit one, what's the payoff? Those are subjective estimates. When you feed subjective estimates into an expected value calculation, a precise number pops out, giving the illusion of scientific certainty. Our expected value for this well is $112.8 million. It's a no-brainer. Let's drill it. It didn't go unnoticed among explorers that if they really wanted to drill a well, they could simply tinker around with the math in a spreadsheet. If they jacked up the hit rate or the payoff, the expected value obediently inflated. This tinkering probably wasn't malicious or even conscious. Remember, when the elephant really wants something, the rider can be trusted to find rationalizations for it. More subtly, the use of expected value made people think about drilling as a numbers game. As Jim Farnsworth, a top leader in BP's exploration unit, said, "Explorers think in terms of risk probabilities. People get so caught up in the numbers that they think, well, if we drill 10 of these 1 in 10 wells, we'll hit at least one of them, and we'll all make a lot of money. But when you do the analysis, you realize that something that is 1 in 10 never works, so it's a false sense of statistical clarity." The odds playing gave everyone a false sense of comfort. Hey, if we drill some dry holes, one of the other holes will hit and make up for it. Explorers are like venture capitalists, hoping for an eBay or a Google to bail them out of an otherwise lousy portfolio. If you were an executive at BP, hoping to cut your exploration costs by 80%, your first mission would be to remove this false sense of comfort. The ambiguity in the goal is allowing rationalization to creep in. So how could you change your team's behavior so that every single drilling operation is taken seriously? How could you leave your team's riders with nowhere to hide? Consider the alternatives for your new strategic rallying cry. We'll double our strikes. No more dumb holes. Let's maximize expected value. Some of them sound promising, but notice the fudge room in all of them. No more dumb holes would be easy for any competent rider to dodge. Would any self-respecting explorer think he was drilling a dumb hole? Doubling strikes is better, but there's still room to rationalize a lot of dry holes. And as for maximize expected value, well, let's just move on. Ian Van, BP's head of exploration at the time, figured out a way to eliminate the fudge room. He announced his new vision. No dry holes. None. Explorers were irate. They thought the goal was preposterous. Their leaders were asking the impossible. Dry holes had always been a normal and acceptable part of doing business. Remember, the number of dry holes outnumbered successes by a factor of 4. Now, Van was defining them as failure. No dry holes was a painful B&W goal. Probabilistic predictions had always provided a cover for failure. As Jim Farnsworth said, we wanted to get away from the language of probability, from people hiding behind the notion that if a 1 in 5 well didn't work, I told you it was 1 in 5, so I was right. No dry holes was an attempt to make people go to the absolute extreme limit to make sure they'd looked at every piece of data and done the right analysis. As explorers began talking about no dry holes, they started taking off their explorer hats and putting on their geologist hats. Lots of things had to go right to create a productive oil field, and geologists had previously devised different tests to evaluate every geologic feature. Was the right carbon-rich substrate available to form oil? Was there a harder impermeable base layer underneath the oil to capture and contain it if it formed? Even if the oil had formed at some point in geologic history, could subsequent underground pressures or temperatures have degraded the oil? The idea of eliminating dry holes prompted geologists to become more systematic about mapping and aggregating the information they had. They color-coded maps: green for aspects that might support an oil field, amber for areas where information was missing, and red for clear counterindications. Then they overlaid the color-coded maps on top of one another, each layer representing a different geologic test. They decided to drill only in regions that were green on every conceivable dimension. No dry holes was effective in stamping out two kinds of rationalizations for poorly conceived drilling operations. One was learning, the convenient notion that even if a particular well doesn't hit, the team will learn so much from the process that future operations will be more successful. Van said, I can give you 100 examples where people made a mistake because they didn't use knowledge they already had. For every one example where we learn something that is valuable for next time. The other common rationalization was that certain wells had strategic value. Callagher said, the last defense of the charlatan is always that something is strategic. This is a strategic well, so we have to drill it. No dry holes removed the fudge room. A well might be strategic, or it might not be, but either way, it better not be dry. David Bamford, BP's chief geophysicist during much of this period, said, I can think of several examples of where technical teams knew a proposed well would be dry, and yet senior management wanted to drill it because of pressure from government or business partners. Previously, it was hard for frontline people to object to these decisions. When your manager is the only one who knows what the partner pressure consists of, how can you possibly raise a credible objection? The no dry holes goal boosted the confidence of the frontline employees. The exploration forum, the peer group accountable for exploration decisions, became more outspoken and pushed back on strategic reasons to engage in low probability explorations. After all, the strategy was no dry holes, not no dry holes unless drilling helps to placate an important partner. The strategy had changed in a way that gave lower-level employees an equally credible voice in the decision. The B&W goal worked exactly as the management team had intended. When BP left nowhere for people to hide, its people stopped trying to hide. They tightened up on their analysis, and they made fewer play-the-odds decisions. They got serious about using every available scrap of data in their decisions, and they toughened up their resistance to governmental and partner pressure. By 2000, BP's hit rate was an industry-leading 2 and 3. That's triple the success of 1989. BP was still hitting dry holes, but the goal had stirred improvements that many had considered impossible. BP transformed itself when it eliminated its own wiggle room. When we drill a hole, it better not be dry. Note that the leaders at BP didn't say, 2 out of 3, that's close enough, let's celebrate. Every dry hole was a failure, and there was no dodging it, because they couldn't easily excuse failure. It was strategic. It was a learning opportunity. They were left with only one choice. Drill smarter next time. 6. If you worry about the potential for inaction on your team, or if you worry that silent resistance may slow or sabotage your change initiative, B&W goals may be the solution. But to be clear, you won't always need a goal that's so unyielding. Crystal Jones's call to become a third grader was not a B&W goal. Let's face it, if kids got third grade level scores on math and science, but not on vocabulary, we'd all let them graduate. Laura Esserman's vision for the breast care center wasn't B&W, and it didn't need to be. What is essential, though, is to marry your long-term goal with short-term critical moves. Esserman's vision was compelling, but it would have been empty talk without lots of behavior-level execution. You have to back up your destination postcard with a good behavioral script. That's a recipe for success. What you don't need to do is anticipate every turn in the road between today and the destination. It's not that plotting the whole journey is undesirable. It's that it's impossible. To think that you can plot a turn-by-turn map to the end, like a leader's vision of MapQuest, is almost certainly hubris. When you're at the beginning, don't obsess about the middle, because the middle is going to look different once you get there. Just look for a strong beginning and a strong ending and get moving. 7. The average investor might make stock-picking decisions by listening to Jim Cramer, or reading news reports, or compulsively watching CNBC. But big institutional investors, such as philanthropic foundations or teachers' retirement funds, get special attention from Wall Street. Historically, investment banks sponsored research departments as a free service to institutional investors. The exchange was clear. The bank hoped that if it made good recommendations, then the investors would use the bank's traders to buy and sell stocks, bringing in revenue for the bank. Because research is, in essence, a lure for big investment dollars, it is taken very seriously on Wall Street. Every year, Institutional Investor magazine asks big investors to assess the research they've received. Based on those responses, the magazine ranks the research analysts in each industry and also provides an overall ranking for the research departments on Wall Street. These institutional investor rankings are treated like holy writ. They drive huge bonuses to individual analysts, and they attract customers to the banks with the best research departments. In 1986, Shearson Lehman's research department ranked a humiliating 15th. Top executives at Shearson wanted a new leader, so they recruited Jack Rivkin, who had built Payne Weber's research department into a powerhouse. The execs' expectations for Rivkin were clear. Get us into the top 5. Rivkin's first impressions of the department were not promising. When I got to Lehman, the research department was a mess. It got no respect. One of Shearson's top analysts, Elaine Garzarelli, said, "The department wasn't disciplined. People did whatever they wanted to do. They didn't have to talk at regular meetings. They didn't have to submit reports at certain times. Absolutely no mention was ever made of the Institutional Investor All-America team." Rivkin made many formal changes to the department. He hired a number 2, Fred Frankel. He successfully petitioned Shearson for a much larger staff and budget. He fired Deadwood on the team. He changed the compensation system for the team. These changes were vital, but ultimately, Rivkin had to influence the day-to-day behavior of the analysts on his team. As an analogy, consider a general manager, GM, running a baseball team. If you have more money at your disposal, you can sign more talented players. You can trade underperformers. You can offer your team a bonus for making the playoffs. These changes are important, but they don't directly influence the way the players play. To do that, you need a coach. Rivkin was both GM and coach. As a coach, he knew he needed members of his team to improve their work dramatically, and that meant he needed to script some of their early moves. He started by announcing that he expected analysts to initiate at least 125 client conversations per month. He required them to take notes on their conversations and post them to the internal network. Both the quantity and the quality of analysts' contacts became a matter of public record. One newly hired analyst said, "Once the report card on analyst contacts was electronically pinned up on a board, all the analysts began trying to get to the front section of the rankings. No one wanted to be near the end. The analysts started asking one another, 'How do you make so many calls? Where do you find the time?' The 125 call benchmark jolted the department, snapped it out of its lackadaisical attitude. Most of the analysts began working 12 to 15 hours per day, nearly every day of the year." Note the clarity of the instructions. This is Rivkin's 1% milk campaign. Rivkin also sought to build a team mentality in the department, fighting against the traditional culture of self-interested cowboys. He demanded that when analysts were making presentations to clients, they cite their colleagues' work at least twice. "I don't want to hear I in the presentation. I want to hear we, and I want to hear other people's names." The forced, at first, sharing of ideas and credit made the team as a whole better, but it also benefited the individual analysts by exposing them to information they otherwise wouldn't have encountered. Rivkin didn't just script the critical moves, make 125 calls and cite your colleagues' work. He also pointed to the destination. "We're going to crack the II, Institutional Investor, top 5. That was something everyone in his department understood and aspired to. In fact, there was a joke that circulated in the department, II or die, but the aspiration was serious. Within 18 months of the turnaround, a full 95% of one group of newly minted analysts broke into the individual II analyst rankings for their industry. Customers were noticing the extra attention they got from Shearson analysts, and for the first time, Shearson analysts were top of mind when Institutional Investor magazine called investors to ask who they relied on most." The direction set by Rivkin prepared the department for a contrarian bet that left the department alone on Wall Street. It was a bet that would cement Shearson's place in the II rankings. In 1988, a Shearson analyst began